thanks to the organizers here from the Institute and from Lee Day. I think this is a very timely event, at least since I started working on these Iraq issues. I don't recall having seen so many people working on these topics brought together, so it's really a pleasure to be here. What I will try to do in my presentation is to focus on a discussion paper that I recently researched and published with Carla Firstman, called The UK Military in Iraq, Efforts and Prospects for Accountability for International Crimes Allegations. So that paper was researched over the spring, over the summer, and we published it and launched it in The Hague, I think, on the 1st of October last year. So it's all fairly recent, but I should say, of course, that I might not necessarily be fully up to date on any developments that have happened over the last 3 months, which is partly due to me just becoming a father. So work has been put a little bit behind in those last couple of months. Before I did that project together with Carla, which was funded by Essex Impact Acceleration Fund, I worked on a British Academy project where the main focus was on complementarity, so trying to understand the various interplays between what is going on at the level of The Hague, so with respect to the ICC's preliminary examination into the UK Iraq case and what's going on domestically. So there's some form of interplay also between these two different projects. A brief note on the methodology of our paper. So of course, and needless to say, we analyze publicly available information, so court decisions and official statements by UK government representatives and statements by the ICC and other documents that you can fairly easily access. And in addition to that, we engaged a range of stakeholders who have been working on these topics. So of course that included people at the ICC level, and we also attempted to engage UK government representatives, so specifically people who are working on the domestic investigations. However, as I shall return to later on in the presentation, that has proven fairly difficult, that not a whole lot were willing to engage with us. We also used freedom of information requests to attempt to get information relating to the UK's investigations and its submissions to the ICC and other relevant material, and not a whole lot came out of that. Indeed, we got very few, if any, substantive responses to our freedom of information requests. I think I will try to use, at the end of the presentation, I will try to give you an example of a freedom of information request, of the response to our request, so you can see on what basis government agencies are denying access to this information we've been requesting. So that's been a serious challenge for doing the research, that a lot of material that we would have liked ideally to access, it simply wasn't possible. So the way we framed this from the outset is that there seems to be basically two of what is often being portrayed as two opposed narratives relating to these accountability, these efforts at achieving accountability for the Iraq claims. And one is the perspective that despite the significant physical and other evidence of serious abuse and wrongful death, a large proportion of criminal investigations have been shut down, and as a result, there's been almost a total lack of criminal accountability for acts of extreme seriousness, which would have, under normal circumstances, we believe, resulted in trial and possibly in conviction and punishment. And then, on the other hand, you have the narrative promoted by the government, or at least certain parts of the government, in particular the MOD, as well as certain media outlets, which is basically saying that this is a question of ambulance chasing lawyers who are just in it for the money, and I mean you're all very familiar with that narrative, and which has really taken the perspective also that this is unfair to the servicemen who served in Iraq and unfair to the military as such. And the way we see it is that these two narratives shouldn't necessarily be opposing, that if you look at it from the perspective of servicemen, then they would have an interest, you would think, in thorough investigations being conducted promptly and with a clear conclusion, rather than, as it has turned out to be, with multiple investigations going on for many years and servicemen being interviewed again and again by different agencies. So from that perspective, we don't think that these two narratives should necessarily be seen as conflicting. Secondly, I don't think we can look at what's going on in the UK without also looking at the ICC's preliminary examination. So it seems clear that examination has framed the government's approach to accountability to a large extent and multiple other interplays that I will, some of which I will briefly touch on in this presentation. So very briefly on that examination, it was reopened in May 2014 after it had been initially closed in 2006 by then prosecutor Moreno Ocampo. It's currently placed in phase three, which means that investigators are looking into issues of admissibility, which includes complementarity, so the legal standard that the ICC cannot proceed to a full investigation if there are genuine domestic proceedings going on, as well as gravity. So that happened in November 2017. Then the Office of the Prosecutor issued its report on examination activities again in November 2018. And that report, my reading of it at least, is that it seems fairly conclusive that the ICC prosecutor would likely not move ahead on the basis of an assessment of complementarity, at least as it currently stands. So basically a view, a perception that what the UK has done and is doing might likely satisfy the Rome Statute's requirements to complementarity. That's just my reading of it, that it does seem fairly conclusive to me. A brief note on government response. I think at the outset it must be recognized that the UK government has cooperated with the ICC. It has significantly engaged the Office of the Prosecutor on these matters and at least publicly taken the view that it does not believe there's any merits in this particular examination, and hence it should be closed on grounds of, well, first they're saying there's no crime base under the Rome Statute, so whatever happened in Iraq was the result of a few bad apples that basically you do not have any widespread or large-scale commission of war crimes in Iraq. Then secondly, the government has been challenging the credibility of the information, and with that goes the credibility of the actors that have provided this information to the Office of the Prosecutor. And lastly, it's saying complementarity. Even if we should assume that there is a crime basis to move ahead with, then complementarity means that the ICC cannot move ahead with this. At the same time, and more broadly perhaps, the government seems to have devised this narrative of ambulance chasing lawyers and taking certain other measures in that regard that seem to have restricted relevant stakeholders' ability to work on this. And even more broadly also, and this is not something I will go into detail with here, but perhaps we can do it in the discussion, also made proposals for adopting a statute of limitations to apply to all previous situations of armed conflict. I believe that's how it's being framed. So that's something the defense committee, the defense subcommittee is currently working on. And at the same time, various proposals for derogating from human rights law in times of armed conflict. So it seems fairly clear that these measures are being taken or being proposed as a way of avoiding that legal claims along what has happened in Iraq are being ever brought again. So here's an example of the response of the UK government at the most recent Assembly of State Parties in The Hague. To me, I wouldn't say I was shocked, but I was quite puzzled that the UK went this direct, because you wouldn't normally, at least other responses I've seen, would not be this direct in basically saying that, yes, we do support the ICC, but you guys need to stop being a human rights monitoring court, and we believe what you're doing with the Iraq examination is basically, you know, sort of a human rights appeal court with respect to our own legal system. And at the same time saying the court must urgently adopt a closure strategy for its cases, including timelines and targets for preliminary examinations, investigations and trials. So this being the UK, it seems to be fairly direct in disseminating a clear dissatisfaction with the ICC's involvement in the situation in Iraq. Here are some other quotes relating to the government's minister's approach to the legal processes and the lawyers that have been involved in it. First, you see Theresa May: "We'll never again in any future conflict let those activist left-wing human rights lawyers harass and harass the bravest of the brave, the men and women of our armed forces." And something along the same lines by former Prime Minister David Cameron, and statements by the former Secretary of Defense Michael Fallon. And finally, Bob Stewart, a member of the Commons Defense Committee, who has been, I think it would be fair to say, quite clear in his opposition to anything having to do with legal processes relating to armed conflicts and any efforts at accountability. So this is a brief overview of the legal processes in the UK relating to the Iraq claims. First, we have criminal investigations, first undertaken by the Royal Military Police, which did lead to a limited number of court martials. I think we're speaking around a handful. And then later on, the establishment of IHAT, the Iraq Historic Allegation Team, which was replaced last year, well, summer 2017, by SPLI, the Service Police Investigation, which in many ways appears to materialize as sort of a mini IHAT. One reason, at least, that I had was closed was that there was significant political opposition to the way I had operated. There was a team of it was called the Red Snapper Group involved in I had, which faced significant criticism for the way investigations were undertaken. But what happened then after IHAT was closed was that SPLI was established, which has operated, it seems, under even less transparency than what was the case with IHAT. And notably, neither the efforts of IHAT nor SPLI have led to any successful trial and convictions, and that is in by itself quite puzzling. You have several thousand claims and a few were forwarded to the Service Prosecution Authority for consideration whether it could be taken forward, but that was ultimately decided against. Then there's the Iraq Fatality Investigations, which aims to provide a narrative account of the immediate circumstances in which the death occurred, and an examination of the wider circumstances in which the death occurred and any lessons that should be learned from that. So not a criminal investigation, but something that's intended to shed light on the broader circumstances in which any of these violations might have happened. next, the civil suits, the public inquiries and judicial reviews that were, many of which were discussed in the session before our lunch break, so I won't go into any details with that in this presentation. Also, and I think this is perhaps frequently forgotten, the military has conducted its own investigations into the Iraq claims published in the Aiken report of 2008 and the Purdy report of 2010. And then finally, this is not a legal process, but something that's worth mentioning. I think the MOD has established a so-called systemic issues working group, which aims to address wider issues, but information on the follow-up and the findings of this groups have not been very clear. And the group seems to focus mainly on issues relating to training needs, which are obviously very important issues, but does not really look at issues relating to the adequacy of investigations and prosecutions. So this is to summarize our assessment that we undertake in this discussion paper of these investigations in the UK. One, it's important to note that there's been almost a total lack of outcome in any criminal justice sense of long-lasting investigations. So these are processes that have been going on for many years. They've been rather costly. They have involved a large number of investigators. I had, I think, at its peak, was employing around 150 investigators. So that's a fairly large government agency when you think about it. Less so under SPLI. I don't have the exact number, but I believe it's around. It's been around 50. So significant resources, in a sense, have gone into these investigations, but as said, there's not been a single successful prosecution coming out of it. Why then is that? There seems to be different issues at play here. One is perhaps that, as also recognized by the UK's own legal system, that the people employed by IHAD and later on SPLI were not necessarily experts in war crimes, so that might be one issue, that you're using former police detectives basically to investigate crimes in Iraq. Secondly, of course, there are questions relating to getting evidence for crimes that did happen now many years ago in a different country, and as Nicolas touched upon in his presentation, in a situation where it must be immensely difficult to get access to that information and evidence. That being said, certain evidence does exist. And again, Nicolas, you touched on that in your presentation, that there are video recordings of at least many of the interrogations that took place. It is not exactly clear to me how these are being reviewed, but the picture we got from speaking to investigators and prosecutors is basically they do not believe that any of the interrogations that have been recorded demonstrate that war crimes were being committed. So of course that then raises the question, what standards, what threshold are being operated with within IHAD, SPLI and the SPA in terms of deciding what amounts to a war crime? Assumedly, you would see at least some of the five techniques being deployed in the context of those interrogations. So does that then mean that the standard set is that does not amount to something that needs to be investigated and prosecuted? Secondly, lack of attention to systemic and systematic issues. It seems clear that IHAD was established in the first place to provide a mechanism under human rights law, which in a sense justifies that you go through these allegations on a case-by-case basis. But that's somewhat different if you're speaking international criminal law, because here the focus is really on, at least within an ICC context, the focus is primarily on those who might have organized or planned, or in other ways are responsible at a higher level for the alleged crimes. And I have personally seen nothing in writing that suggests that either IHAD or SPLI have looked at these claims from the perspective of whether it could be systematic, and that despite some of the court findings that we spoke about in the session prior to the break. Political interference and lack of commitment to accountability. It would be fair to say, I think, that there have been various concerns relating to the independence and impartiality of these investigative mechanisms, some of them expressed by judges within the UK legal system, and admittedly certain changes took place in the structure and setup of IHAT following that criticism that it was not sufficiently independent under human rights law. Even when those changes took place, it seems that the Ministry of Defence had quite an influence on how these investigative processes that were meant to be fully independent from the MOD were in reality run, and part of that could be due to the implications of the MOD making the decisions relating to budget. But there are reports of other forms of interference also, I think we can say. And then secondly, it goes to that level of interference that I think the statements by government ministers that I gave some examples on before, that clearly created a climate where it's been very difficult for investigators to look into this. Finally, lack of transparency. So I already touched a bit on that, but it's been striking the extent to which the government or government agencies have refused to engage this research and initially delayed freedom of information requests to then ultimately use the exceptions to say that they cannot be answered. And I think I will round off this presentation by giving you an example of one such freedom of information request, the response to our request from the Attorney General's office. So you see our question first goes to our request goes to obtaining material relating to the government's submissions to the office of the ICC prosecutor. So it became clear to us in the context of this research that the UK government has made various submissions to the office of the prosecutor, some of them dealing with issues of complementarity, so speaking to, assumedly, to the UK's, to legal processes in the UK. And I highlighted in yellow here what I think is the most significant part of the answer, which is that the Attorney General's office cannot give this information with reference to concerns of international relations. So basically saying that if this information came out in the public domain, that would harm the UK's relationship with the Office of the Prosecutor and more broadly the ICC, on the basis that the ICC expects that these kind of submissions are confidential and are not put in the public domain. To me, that does not seem likely. It does not seem likely that there could be anything in that submission that it might harm the UK's reputation, for sure, but how could it harm the relationship between the UK and the ICC if it comes out in the public domain what the UK has to say on its own legal processes? That it seems very unlikely to me that that could be the case. So here, the rest of that quote. So that's just one example of a response to a freedom of information request that, in this case, the response has been delayed since last summer, so that's quite a while also. So it has been extremely difficult to get any of this information, which is hugely problematic, we think. So I think I'll simply round off with that. Thank you.
Over to Elizabeth. Hello. Thank you, Depo. And huge thanks to the Bonavero Institute and to Lee Day and to Melanie Jacques, who had the original idea for this seminar today and helped to organise it. I'm going to speak today about an article that I'm submitting to the Journal of Conflict and Security Law this month. It's an archival and documentary analysis of the British Army's training materials in operational law, which currently includes the law of armed conflict, international humanitarian law, a mere sprinkling of relevant international human rights law on the use of force and on the treatment of detainees, including prisoners of war, and also a module newly introduced since 2016 on investigations and accountability, explaining to troops the risk that they may face prosecution at a court-martial or indeed at the ICC for violations of international law. I'm interested in the obligation to train troops in international humanitarian law because I believe that these preventive norms in international humanitarian law are taken for granted, are pithily or laconically expressed in the treaties, and there's very little engagement with state practice as to how these norms are implemented. So to focus just on training, states must disseminate IHL as widely as possible, including to the civilian population, and they must integrate the treaty texts, the content thereof, into programs of military instruction or training. This is found in Geneva law, in Hague law, unusually in IHL, but in common with other procedural norms, such as the provision of legal advisers, it applies in peace and in war. And I believe on my interpretation of the four Geneva Conventions and of weapons law that it applies in relation to the law of NIAC, non-international armed conflict, and international armed conflict. This IHL training obligation was suggested in the Oxford Manual of War on Land in 1880. It became binding in the first Geneva Convention of 1906, and it is now quite extensive. There are also obligations in international human rights law to train members of the military, including Article 10 of the Convention Against Torture, which requires law enforcement officials, civil or military, who have responsibility for detainees to be trained in the prohibition of torture and cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment or punishment. The British Army's IHL training became my critical case study because of significant flaws in that training, found most clearly in the Baha Moussa public inquiry report in relation to troops deployed to Iraq in the first phase of Operation Telich in 2003, and also because I was sceptical of the much vaunted reforms to this training that the MOD repeatedly asserted had taken place at various stages without providing solid documentary evidence of the nature of these apparent improvements to training. But as my archival research progressed, I noticed some patterns. I noticed some historic patterns of assertion dating from just after the UK had ratified the four Geneva Conventions of 1949, when it ratified in 1957, assertion that IHL training was already taking place, that mirrored these assertions that training had been addressed or implemented during and after the Baha Moussa public inquiry, during and after the Al Suwaidi public inquiry, and frequently, but with no detail given, in Parliament. I also noticed patterns of violation that were coming to the courts, that were coming towards these public inquiries, and in my archival research, I noticed patterns of violation in the prohibitions of torture and inhuman treatment shared between IHL and international human rights law. And similar patterns of conduct recurred from Kenya, Aden, Cyprus, Northern Ireland, and Iraq. And that calls into question the narrative after the Baha Moussa public inquiry report that the cause of the death of Baha Moussa and of the torture and inhuman treatment of others detained with him was merely a doctrinal gap and a loss of institutional memory within the military about the prohibition of the five techniques found to be inhuman and degrading treatment in the case of Ireland and UK in the 1970s. So keeping those themes of assertion, violation, and institutional response in mind, I'm going to be answering three sets of research questions on the chronology, the content, and the context of the British Army's training in IHL. So I'm going to be asking when the British Army first implemented its training, how the history of training or its absence correlates with those recurrent patterns of violations that I spoke about, going right up to the point of the facts found in the Al-Saran case, so in 2003 and in 2007, and when the timing of when the Ministry of Defence implemented changes to this training. Then I'm going to ask how comprehensive the current training materials are, what is present and what is absent, and then I'm considering the context, which comes full circle with Thomas's research. Why is it that there is so much emphasis on training and preventive mechanisms, while investigations into violations of international law by British armed forces are rushed to a close? What does that hide from the historical record, and what obligations are underemphasized? So, going back very far, there's no evidence that the British Army trained its troops in relevant IHL at the time of the First World War, when the 1906 Geneva Convention did require such instruction. But the historian Isabel Hull has found that Britain began to incorporate IHL into its field manual from 1904. Oppenheim and Edwards' 1914 military manual reflects Hague and Geneva law in some detail, plus prohibitions on asphyxiating gases, bombardment, and the St. Petersburg Declaration 1868 on explosive projectiles. At that time, and during the First World War, British military doctrine permitted reprisals and collective punishment of civilians, the destruction of their homes, but urged against hostage taking. In that military manual, there's already a racist colonial mindset by the authors. It asserts that the rules of international law do not apply in wars with, and I quote, uncivilized states and tribes. The Canadian researcher Frederick Maigret recalls that Britain was the only state at the 1899 Hague Conference to argue that exploding dum-dum bullets should be permissible in colonial warfare. Until the 1944 military manual, superior orders were still a defence to war crimes. But in the 1944 and 1958 military manuals, soldiers were then expected to question and, if necessary, to disobey obviously illegal orders. Yet the historian Hugh Bennett has found that by the time of the Korean War, this obligation was not disseminated to troops, even though it remained in the military manual. There's an interesting theme there about a distinction between state practice and opinio iuris, with the military manual being opinio iuris and state practice being the failure to train. There are archival gaps in the syllabus for Sandhurst and the Officers' Staff College. We simply do not know if IHL was trained at that time. Neither the Court of Appeal nor the Supreme Court in the KU case in the killing of unarmed civilians in Malaya shows any evidence that national servicemen were trained in relevant IHL. My own archival research for the period after 1957, when the UK ratified the four Geneva Conventions, tentatively suggests that IHL training was not taking place at all. I found in the Little Heart archive at King's College London some letters from Gerald Draper, a former army lawyer, who concluded in 1961 that there were statements to Parliament that were simply untrue, that the Geneva Conventions were being disseminated to troops. And his reason for this, for which I did not find corroboration in the archive, was that he believed that personnel would become more wary of nuclear deterrence if they were trained in IHL's principle of distinction, and that therefore there had been a decision to delay the implementation of IHL training. And from the 1950s onwards, both prior to and after the UK's ratification of the four Geneva Conventions, you can see these patterns of torture and inhuman treatment emerging and recurring. The 150,000 people who were estimated to have been detained in Kenya between 1952 and 1960 Many suffered beatings, stress positions, rape, and sexually degrading treatment. In the Matua case in 2013, the UK gave a belated £14 million settlement. And just 2 days ago, on Wednesday, the government reached a £1 million settlement in respect of 33 torture victims who were detained in an uprising in Cyprus between 1955 and 59. In Aden, there were types of interrogation technique, types of inhuman treatment in common with Northern Ireland and then Iraq. Detainees suffered false wall standing, enforced nakedness, and beatings. And that occurred despite joint directives from the MOD, which paraphrases much of common Article 3, a delayed attempt in the 1960s for the UK to acknowledge the relevance of the IHL of non-international armed conflict. The recurrence of similar techniques, including in Aden, where detainees were forced to sit near air conditioning units, which was similar to Baha Moussa and those detained with him being forced to sit in a generators. The recurrence of those similar techniques casts doubt on that consensus in the Baha Moussa public inquiry report and subsequently in the rhetoric that followed, that there'd been a mere loss of institutional memory about the prohibition of the five techniques. And this is why, through deficits in training, deficits in doctrine, that this inhuman treatment occurred. I also found patterns that recurred of institutional response. So it is not at all new since the war in Iraq that some victims have been systematically disbelieved or it has been claimed that they exaggerate their testimony. Nor is it new, the MOD's arguable differential emphasis on physical versus mental ill treatment. So the Compton Committee report into the five techniques in Northern Ireland largely ignored the risk of severe mental suffering, focusing just on the infliction of severe physical pain and suffering. So all of this proves a correlation between patterns of violations in those prohibitions of torture and inhuman treatment shared between IHL and international human rights law, and patterns of deficient or absent training in IHL. It does not prove, of course, causation between the absent or deficient training in IHL and the existence of those violations. On to Iraq, then. The Baha Moussa Public Inquiry collected evidence on the training that found that the relevant individual training directives, 1998 at the time of the first Operation Telich, and then again in 2003, required soldiers to attend 40 minutes of annual training in IHL. Much of it was based on an outdated Cold War era video, a PowerPoint presentation, and an aide memoir for soldiers. Pre-deployment training in IHL did not begin until, I believe, the second phase of Operation Telich. I found that the training time given to IHL was, in fact, half that dedicated to training in the dangers of substance misuse, which says something about priority setting in relation to training, especially considering the complexity of IHL and its prohibitions. Baha Moussa Public Inquiry Report did find longer training at Sandhurst, but still a considerable level of generality in that training. There was no indication that the training covered the prohibition on the five techniques. Witnesses to the inquiry remembered being told to treat soldiers, to treat detainees humanely, but they could not articulate what that meant. And that illustrates the dangers of simply narrating or disseminating prohibitions and requirements in IHL. By 2007, when Mr. Al-Wahid suffered beatings, sleep deprivation, and sensory deprivation with blackened goggles, hooding had already been prohibited. And in 2006, an operational law branch had been established, with the law of armed conflict included within the new military annual training tests, or MAT. But at that stage, 2006, and for the next few years, the law of armed conflict was combined with values and standards, the British Army's approach to training military ethics, substance misuse, and equality and diversity awareness. So IHL was taught in a 22-minute video, and it was tested in 10 multiple-choice questions. And the Army Legal Services were much more helpful for my research than for Thomas's, because I do have documentary evidence from freedom of information requests for these historic past papers, for the relevant directives, and for recent and current instructional materials and tests. Even in 2008, when the law of armed conflict gained its own military annual training test, the questions that examine troops' knowledge sometimes reflected policy rather than law. So to take just one example, the question, what is the main reason why you should always treat the local population humanely, had as its authorised correct answer, it will help to win the battle for hearts and minds. So there's a broader strategic purposive justification that has nothing to do with the binding quality of IHL. Jumping ahead a little bit to 2011 and the conclusion of the Bahamusa Public Inquiry Report, I think it's instructive that it took an external body to push the MOD into substantive action on training. IHL training then gradually began to improve. But my findings were that, contrary to repeated assertions to Parliament and to public inquiries by the MOD, those reforms to training were not implemented and done by 2011 and by 2014, but there was a much more gradual and nuanced progress towards improving the comprehensiveness, but not necessarily the evaluation of training materials in IHL. So I found minimal improvements from 2004 to 2011, and more substantive but still gradual reforms from 2011 to 2016. Particular turning points are the Comprehensive Operational Law Training Directive of February 2014 and its implementation in a comprehensively expanded MAT 7 on the Law of Armed Conflict in 2015. There was also an instructional DVD on the handling of prisoners and detainees, known in British Army parlance as SEPERS, captured persons, that does systematically tick every box of the recommendations accepted by the MOD that were made in the Bahamusa Public Inquiry Report. So I'll think about that content. But I will say that whatever nuanced optimism follows on the content of these current training materials, it's worth pausing and noting that this is a tragically belated implementation of long-standing treaty obligations to train troops in IHL. So, how comprehensive are the training materials? I'll go first to the Operational Law Training Directive 2014, then briefly to the Use of Force module, and then to the SEPERS module on the treatment of prisoners of war and other detainees. So the Operational Law Training Directive reads like an ambitious law school syllabus for an IHL course. Both soldiers and officers must understand the difference between IAC, International Armed Conflict, and NIAC, Non-International Armed Conflict. They must all understand and be able to implement the principles of military necessity, humanity, distinction, proportionality, the rules on target identification and on civilians directly participating in hostilities, a rule that has considerable nuance and cannot be speedily taught in a DVD of a couple of hours' duration. Also, they must be able to implement precautions and the duty to end an attack which might be indiscriminate. They must recognise and protect the ICRC's emblems, cultural properties, and works and installations containing dangerous forces. They must comply with weapons prohibitions, understand perfidy, ruses, and the prohibition on using human shields. Prisoners of war, civilians, medical and religious personnel must be protected. This directive is, I believe, a good faith attempt at comprehensive training in IHL. It covers all basic and continuation training to the armed forces, both soldiers and officers. The only thing outside its scope is specialist training of army legal services lawyers. And I'd noticed a gap in the content on what we would call Article 5 of the ECHR, if you're looking at it from a human rights perspective. And I believe that gap is probably because that the issues of liberty and security and the lawfulness of detention are dealt with by army lawyers. Training is scripted and it's delivered on a train-the-trainers basis, with army legal services officers training non-lawyers who must then stick to the script, stick to the PowerPoint. I'm concerned about the use of IHL terms of art because of the number of soldiers who struggle with literacy or who struggle learning in classroom contexts. There's also no norm-by-norm evaluation of soldiers' understanding in their MAT 7 test results. The data that's collected is merely a tick-box approach in a personnel record as to whether or not they have received the training in IHL. The directive's also silent on the law of non-international armed conflict, which could be very progressive in terms of teaching soldiers all the norms which apply in international armed conflict, and so that as a default and as a reflex, they will apply these more expansive protections to non-international armed conflict deployments as well. So, going to the instructional DVD on captured persons. The script is a detailed tick box implementation of all accepted Baha Moussa Public Inquiry recommendations on this point. It's an amalgam of the Third Geneva Convention and the prohibition on the five techniques. Stress positions are defined with quite a subjective high threshold as painful, extremely uncomfortable, or exhausting to maintain. There could be a problem in the application of this if a soldier who's trained to a considerable degree of physical fitness cannot adequately empathize in the moment with the exhaustion of a detainee who is not. Hooding is prohibited at any time for any purpose, and I'm quoting deliberately, SEPAs must be protected from assault, abuse, and any other humiliating or degrading treatment. This is a considerable improvement on simply repeating the requirement for humane treatment, but it does not attain the standards in Article 17 of the Third Geneva Convention, in which prisoners of war who refuse to answer questions may not be threatened, insulted, or exposed to any unpleasant or disadvantageous treatment of any kind. Couple of gaps. There is no explicit prohibition on sexually degrading treatment. If the MOD were to have been proactive in its reform of its training materials, it could have looked at the full range of ill-treatment being alleged and not merely the ill-treatment found proven by the Baha Moussa Public Inquiry. They could have made sure that prohibitions on degrading treatment addressed forced nakedness, as occurred in Aden, addressed intimate searches that were experienced as being invasive or that were conducted for the amusement of soldiers. Physical vulnerability is acknowledged more readily. The elderly appear implicitly to be acknowledged in the text. Some SEPAs may be vulnerable persons and special rules may apply for them. The prohibition on verbal abuse is too briefly acknowledged, reflecting at the time that this instructional material was designed, the Haider Ali Hussein case on Challenge Direct. So I predict that from these training materials, there will be a considerably greater understanding of the prohibitions on inhuman and degrading treatment and of torture of detainees. I predict also that the failure to have a proactive approach to the reform of these training materials means that some of those other recurrent patterns of violations, some of those other types of ill treatment may recur in future deployments unless the training materials are reformed. To conclude with some context, historically, the IHL training obligation was long delayed in the UK, and my archival research suggests this might have been in order to maintain the legitimacy in the armed forces of the nuclear deterrent. Deficient and absent IHL training merely correlates with patterns of violations, particularly violations of the prohibitions on torture and inhuman treatment that are found in both IHL and international human rights law. Gradually following the Baha Moussa public inquiry, so especially from 2011 to 2016, the MOD has reformed and improved the comprehensiveness of its training to soldiers and other land forces. There are silences, not least on sexual humiliation and sexual assault. There are also silences on forced exercise and exposure of detainees to extremes of temperature. These may be a risk factor for violations in future deployments. But in this broader context, The House of Commons Defence Select Committee subcommittee has written that violations of IHL in Iraq and Afghanistan were caused by deficits in training, that no soldier should be prosecuted if they received this deficient training, and that therefore all investigations into violations of international law in Iraq should be closed. I believe that this imbues training with more explanatory power and more exculpatory power than it has. IHL training is required by treaties. It's arguably necessary to prevent violations, but it's far from sufficient. This rhetoric also hides from the historic record the role of the command chain in the knowledge of and failure to prevent torture and inhuman treatment in Iraq and in British military detention across the decades. The training reforms are genuinely comprehensive, but they don't obviate an obligation to investigate and to prosecute. So training reforms can be a neat bureaucratic veneer for the horror of violations, and training and obligations coexist with investigatory obligations. Attending to one does not preclude the other. Thanks.
Okay, so as I indicated at the start, turn this on. We now have some time for questions and discussion of the issues that have arisen in this panel, and then we'll broaden it out to reflecting on the day as a whole. So I see Leora's hand is up already. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask about my main question is.
Sorry, somebody's just getting a mic to you.
So we've spoken a lot about omissions in training and failures in training and gaps in training. Where do people learn to torture? There's a kind of notion here that the sort of whole systemic breakdown, these are failures. These are failures in a sort of standard. But I don't know how to torture. So where do people learn to torture?
Okay, should we collect a couple? Clive?
Thank you. It's Clive Baldwin, Human Rights Watch. Thank you for all the presentations. There's a specific question, I think mostly for Thomas, but it's particularly why do you think there's this complete failure to prosecute under the doctrine of command responsibility? Probably most people know that, but that's the specific doctrine which is in the UK law and under the ICC Act of commanders, civilian and military can be held criminally liable for failure to prevent or to hand over the matter for prosecution. Both, why is there a failure on the military side, including in the Bahamusa prosecution of Colonel Mendonca, but also on the civilian side, including, just one example, the Bahamusa inquiry seemed to show that at least some ministers had ICRC and other evidence of abuses going on. Thanks.
Can you maybe responses to those questions first, and then we'll take some more. Elizabeth, where do people learn how to torture?
The answer is that there is an institutional memory of these techniques, but there's also arguably an embodied memory of these techniques. Basic training, speaking generally, in many militaries, involves physical punishment and involves the experience of fear, involves exposure to extremes of temperature, often hunger, fatigue, at least verbal abuse, from the command chain in order to instill that it is a command chain. The historian Joanna Burke has talked to a considerable extent about the brutalizing effects of basic training and military culture that then might either shape and legitimate soldiers' preconceptions as to what might be not so shocking when applied to detainees, but could also allow them to reenact those particular forms of torture and ill-treatment. And the Bahamusa Public Inquiry spoke about exposure to conduct after capture training, in which personnel were exposed to unlawful treatment that they might have faced if they were captured and detained as prisoners of war. And one of the recommendations of the Bahamas Public Inquiry Report was that the fact of the unlawfulness of these types of conduct was to be more emphasized. But I think your question points to a greater problem when lawyers are gathered to talk about these problems, because our research questions tend to focus on the treaties, on their obligations, on procedures to present, and they don't focus on the interdisciplinary questions. My doctoral thesis actually does focus on some of those interdisciplinary questions, but it entirely depends how you're framing your research questions for any particular audience. So I was speaking to a group of Quaker campaigners against torture a couple of months back, and I wanted to ask how these training materials, what they're expected to change and what they're not expected to change. And under the second heading, I was clustering points of attitude, points of institutional memory, arguments of what I'd call false reciprocity, that much like Alexander Blackman said in relation to his victim in Afghanistan, it's the least that he would have done to us. So where do they learn to torture, not specifically on the techniques, or where do they think that torture might be legitimated?
I mean, I just raised this question in 2003, because when I went and challenged the interrogator said this is part of UK doctrine. So I reported that in an almost contemporaneous memo to the general, and I said I was told it accorded with UK doctrine. It may well accord with doctrine, but it breaches international law. So the response I got was, this is doctrine, when I saw the five techniques. I then saw the chief intelligence officer who showed me a document with this in. I said, well, I didn't write it and I wouldn't have approved it. But when it came to the Bahamusa inquiry, that document couldn't be found. So I don't know. The other interesting thing was that the interrogators were not part of divisional troops, they were a bolt-on extra. And they said, we don't answer to the division, we answer to London. I raised this in the House of Commons in select committee inquiry, and no one knew what we answer to London means. So interrogators were coming under someone's separate command, which again raises the question, to what extent were they being directed to do this? It's really interesting to pose the question, why did the five techniques not die out in 1978? If it was part of doctrine, that's one answer. The other answer I've heard is the escape and evasion exercises. That would happen to you, therefore you did it to them. But is that really a plausible explanation? And it doesn't really fit with the narrative that I was given when I first challenged it. So I just throw that in for sort of wider context.
Thank you. Thomas, do you respond to Clive's question?
Thanks, Clive. I think the answer to your question is very straightforward, because there's no interest in seeing that happen, neither in the military leadership or at the level of political leadership. And I can only suppose that the reason for that is exactly what Nicholas points to here, that this reaches far up in the system. So if you allow investigative mechanisms to pursue that route, then you might end up at the most senior level in the MOD. So to me, it seems clear that this is very deliberate, that you create, in this case, a big agency with 150 employees to investigate these cases, but you do it in such a way that only the focus is only on direct physical perpetrators. And I think some of our research findings demonstrate that whenever investigators were pursuing some line of inquiry that would move beyond that, then investigative teams would be split apart, broken down and terminated. So that makes it very difficult, of course. And then at the same time, of course, it seems the UK has been trying to portray to the office of the ICC prosecutor that they are indeed looking at systemic issues. So again, you got a conflict there, and just a quote on that. So now I said in the presentation that I think the Office of the Prosecutor's report on preliminary examinations in November 2018 seems quite conclusive in terms of complementarity. That being said, there's one paragraph that says the information available indicates that the focus of the UK's investigative and prosecutorial efforts regarding alleged crimes in Iraq has largely focused on low-level physical perpetrators and mid-level supervisors, while also examine pattern evidence. So I think that can be read perhaps in different ways.
Can I invite Melanie and Nicholas actually to come and join us here, because we're running out of time. We'll continue to take some questions, but if you can come and join us, maybe if we can add one seat. Svetlana, can you give them a mic? So we'll have one roving mic and maybe one mic for the two of them here. Does anyone have any further questions to pose to either Thomas or Elizabeth?
Yeah, thank you. I'm Andreas Schulhoff, the European Center for Constitution and Human Rights. And my question would be maybe particularly to Thomas about the impact the ICC preliminary examination had on developments here in UK domestic proceedings and politics. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on that question.
Well, you're thinking about that. Any other questions just for Thomas and Elizabeth? Let's take one more. Just here.
Thank you. I'm Shuba from LIDE. A question for Elizabeth. In your research, which seems to have been very in-depth, have you come across training, doctrinal, or guidance issued by the military about to troops about what, how to resolve inconsistencies between its military doctrine in the context of operating with coalition forces and how those principles from other forces are integrated or not integrated in UK doctrine.
Thomas.
I think that's a really important question, Andreas, not least because the Office of the ICC Prosecutor operates with the framework of positive complementarity, so saying that it's a policy objective, basically, that by conducting preliminary examinations that is seen to prompt and encourage national authorities to take more seriously obligations to investigate and prosecute domestically. I think in the case of the UK, it certainly had an impact. One, in terms of keeping alive probably an agenda that might otherwise have easily been shut down at an earlier stage. I think that's important. Secondly, it probably kept alive institutions for longer than what they would otherwise have been kept alive. And specifically, I mean, I had that there was political opposition to the existence of IHAD earlier on, and if you read the considerations that took place in the Commons Defence Committee, then exactly the being quite transparent in this case, actually, that exactly the concern was what would happen if we close IHAD, might that trigger a full ICC investigation? But ultimately, then the Defence Committee came to the conclusion that it was probably rather unlikely that a full investigation would nonetheless be opened, even if we shut down IHAD. So, you know, to summarize, I think IHAD would likely have been closed early on, and SPLI perhaps never established had it not been for the ICC. You see that impact. I think it promotes the existence of the preliminary examination, promotes exactly what we're doing right now. It gives merit, I think, to further engagement by human rights defenders, by academics, and in a sense set standards for what the UK ought to do, at least, right? So, from that perspective, I think it has been important and will probably remain important as long as it stays alive.
See, Thomas's presentation, his main presentation, you might have at the end thought, ah, what's the point? Now he's given us a note of optimism, which would have been a nice place to end, but we have other things to talk about. Yeah, Elizabeth.
I wish I had material on this, and I don't. And I've been trying to think about why that might be. I've had access to the directives and to basic and continuation training instructional material and examinations. I was told from the beginning that I would never have access to pre-deployment training or mission-specific training. It's possible. These are usually classified because they're based on the rules of engagement. It's possible that discussions on how to deal with these differences of interpretation or outright disagreements between states in multinational operations might be in that pre-deployment training.
I would invite, if Nicholas has any thoughts on that, I'd be interested to hear them as well, from your kind of practical perspective.
Yeah, I mean, there were one or two corrections on what you said. I know, because I was in the Land Warfare Centre. So we did do pre-deployment training prior to Telic 1. Mm-hmm. My officers went out to 16,000 troops. I gave them a set script, and I did use the words humanity and dignity. I take your point, though, as to what does that mean to a young soldier when I say humanity and dignity. To us, it's all obvious. But to them, it may not be, and clearly wasn't. We did then implement a new training regime with a very advanced video, which I don't know if you've seen it, but it was, which I thought was quite good. Yeah. Mm. So I thought the video was quite good. And then we had the problem, to what extent do they understand it? Because after the Camp Breadbasket case, or if you read the interviews, they said, well, didn't you have a law of armed conflict training? I said, yeah, but it's just a blur. So they did admit that they'd been to it, and all right, it wasn't great, it was pretty primitive, but there is a bit where they capture civilians in a Cold War scenario, and it says, stop, you must not abuse civilians, you know. It's not up to date, and it's not, you know, attractive particularly, but they did have that training, and they had it every year, but they said it was just a blur, and I just put in front of a video. So we then organized a system whereby we tested them, but we then had the problem. Well, we said we're not going to deploy anyone without testing them to show they've understood it. And then we had the problem, A, what level do you set it at, where some will have a reading age of 11? So how do you make it so clear that an 11-year-old, someone with a capacity of reading of an 11-year-old and a brigadier with postgraduate qualifications through the yin-yang is insulted being put in front of this and given this test? And then if they failed it deliberately, they were non-deployable. Okay, so you see the horns of the dilemma there. That's not easy, but you know, obviously we strove to explain it to them. But I'm actually, by what you've said, I'm hugely encouraged with the development in training and the level of sophistication that it's got to. And I take from all this, despite all the legal mess and the litigation and the casualties, both legal and otherwise, that we've got to a better place than we were in 2003. So I'm rather hoping. I'll give you an anecdote. I spoke to a Royal Marine last year, and I talked to him about the Blackburn case. And I was really interested to see what the response would be. And he said, no, it was wrong. We will support our men if they get caught up in these things. But what he did was wrong, and have no truck with it in the Royal Marines. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. You know, he crossed the line. We will support our men. We'll pull them out. That's part of our military ethos. But what he did was wrong. We've got no time for it. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, that was actually a really encouraging sort of anecdote as to how the army were perceiving these things. So I must admit, I'm not pessimistic at the end of at this stage of proceedings, because it's got some way to run. But I think we are on an upward curve. Things are, as use the Labour Party, things can only get better. That's tempting fate, isn't it? I'll hand that back.
A very brief right of reply on that point. I did acknowledge in my presentation the Army Individual Training Directives 1998 and 2003, and folded that in with the findings of the Bahamas Public Inquiry on the paucity of training in pre-deployment in IHL pre-deployment in Operation Telic 1. There were directives between Operation Telic 1 and Operation Telic 2, in which I believe you were involved, Nicholas, including the prohibition of hooding, that then meant that the pre-deployment training in Operation Telic 2 was that much more substantive than the pre-deployment training in Operation Telic 1. But a further criticism made by the Bahamissa Public Inquiry report was that the Cold War era video that I also mentioned, that troops received as part of their basic and continuation training, that training and the simulations that were given in practical training stopped at the point of capture. So there wasn't merely a doctrinal gap, there wasn't merely an institutional loss of memory as regards the five techniques, but there was a complete lacuna in training as to how to treat the detainees once they are detained.
I accept that. I mean, but the other interesting thing about all of this is there's no such instance from the first Iraq War. So 1991, we don't have these problems. So when I'm preparing myself going forward, I take the lessons learned file from the first Iraq War, and I'm not wading into interrogation problems or problems with treatment on capture. It is not on my radar. So it's really interesting to know, why did that happen? If we've got this post-colonial legacy running right the way through from, you know, Kenya and all the way through to present day, why does that war get missed out? And what happened to bring that about? And that's really interesting.
I suspect Elizabeth has...
I do. Either an answer or a theory. Really, really brief.
Yeah,
it's both.
Very quick.
The First Iraq War, 1991, I've mic'd up, thanks, was an international armed conflict, and I had actually an on-the-record interview with the then Army Legal Services Officer Charles Garraway on that point, and he explained his techniques of training in relation to the Third Geneva Convention. And he said repeatedly to soldiers, imagine it's you in the mirror, it's you in the mirror, which is not, of course, imparting all the various prohibitions in a great deal of detail, but it is apparently having this notion of parity, equality, and potentially empathy. Darius Rejali has written on the causes of torture and has speculated that there are various institutional and organizational aspects of asymmetric or counterinsurgency conflict that include the units having much less centralized control and supervision, which has implications for command responsibility in these types of non-international armed conflict. And Kenya, Aden, perhaps slightly less so Northern Ireland, but certainly Iraq and aspects of Afghanistan would have had those elements of disaggregated action by individual units taking detainees under a largely uncertain legal framework.
Can I just add one thing about different nations? Anecdotally, there was anecdotal evidence that the Americans thought we weren't going in hard enough. So to what extent does that play into the way you approach things like interrogation? So I just throw that in as well.
I know there are a couple more questions from the audience. So let me take, first of all, Mark, if you can introduce it, and then Leora. Yeah.
I can't resist, Mark Latimer from Ceasefire. I can't resist just adding to that last comment that I remember talking to a Sunni MP in Baghdad, and she said to me, I was talking about Abu Ghraib and what the British were up to in Basra, and she said, we pray that if our boys are taken, they are taken by the British or the Americans and not by the Iraqis. But fascinating debate about, what IHL people can do to train squaddies about IHL and whether or not there is enough command and control. But I wonder whether actually that is missing the point. It's the command and control that is the problem. And probably more at the very highest level, the political message that is being sent. I mean, I think the Blackman case has been referenced three times already. That extraordinary video camera footage that keeps on being played on the news, I'm sure you're all familiar with it. It's extraordinary for a number of reasons, not least because he quotes from Shakespeare as he's killing, but also because he cites the Geneva Conventions. Here is a man that doesn't just know that what he's doing is wrong, but he can cite the legal instrument that prohibits his action. But, you know, 18 months ago, we have a minister, when asked about returning foreign fighters from Syria to Britain, and he says, oh, actually, they shouldn't be returned, they should be killed. Now, slightly ambiguous, perhaps, in the worst construction, clear promotion of a war crime. And it's the way in which, when the abuses are detailed, when they come up, this strategy of either denial or justification by politicians or by always retired members of the armed forces that are dragged up by the MOD to come on, this is the really dangerous message. So I'm not so sure it isn't the army lawyers that we should be taking to task. I think we should be taking to task ourselves as human rights advocates, because we're not confronting those deliberate, very dangerous arguments that are being put from the highest level.
Okay, final question from the audience.
I just wanted to come back to this question of training and institutional culture. To what extent you're engaged, you've engaged with a sort of work on canteen culture or police culture, that sort of norms versus cultural frameworks, because, I mean, as I've been listening today, I keep thinking about the differences between the way that the police respond to certain accusations. I mean, if you look at the sort of whole process of a response to institutional racism in the police, in the metropolitan police particularly, how they have gone about trying to transform that institution. Why is there no engagement with this at the military level, at the sort of sense in which we take this on board? So that's the one point, as a sort of policy question, why are we not engaging with how these cultures breed and develop? And the other point is that there seems to be a missing trick here with the positive aspect of Article 3, because we look at everything as sort of investigative frameworks once the effect of, once the torture harm or the inhuman degrading treatment harm has occurred. But what about the positive obligation aspect, which is about prevention? To what extent are we making arguments within that context of saying Article 3 requires the prevention of torture?
So it's just past 3:00. One of the things we wanted to do was to end the day by sort of looking to the future and thinking about what the future might hold. And I'm wondering if we could just do that by me directing one question to each person on the panel related to the future. My first question actually is which will be directed to Elizabeth, is sort of it's close to, I think, the question Leora was asking about training. It's not quite about the future, but it's related. And it's sort of trying to tie together what Thomas was talking about and what Elizabeth was talking about. So Thomas was talking about the investigations and was talking about the ICC proceedings. And I was wondering, Elizabeth, have you found any evidence that the improvement in training that you were talking about is influenced in any way by some of these activities that are going on in relation to investigations, some of these activities that are going on in relation to attempts to prosecute? And if we add Leora's second question to that as well, is there any evidence that some of these improvements in training are a sort of response to the idea that we have an obligation to prevent these things, whether it's an obligation in human rights law, IHL? So that's your question. Thomas, I was going to ask you a question about, again, looking to the future, the ICC. So the ICC engages in this long process of preliminary examinations. And your prediction is, well, it looks like it's going to sort of come to nothing, in that you sort of think they will, in the end, just close it down and nothing will happen. One of the things you pointed out that the UK said should happen with these ICC preliminary examinations is that they should be time limited. It's all gone on too long. And I wanted to ask you, do you think that's a good thing, and do you think that will happen, that these preliminary examinations will be time limited? that's your question. Melanie, your question's about the cases that you've been involved in and that you described, and you set out for us the sort of legal issues. And just wondering, are there some legal questions that you think are still going to come in this litigation as it goes forward? Are there some legal issues that are sort of on the horizon and that we should be thinking about now? So that's your question. Nicholas, your question relates to, you know, you described for us very vividly the difficulty of actually implementing these obligations in the context of an armed conflict, particularly detention review, and sort of vividly saying, how are we going to do this? Well, we now have a judgment from the High Court, an appeal saying this is what we have to do. So I'm sort of putting that question back to you. How are we going to do this? How is the military actually going to implement? And is it possible, or is there some way around it? So first, back to Elizabeth, her question about training. Yeah.
I think I have to answer both limbs of your question in the negative. So firstly, is there any evidence that these improvements in training are influenced by investigations and prosecutions? Only thinly, in the sense that the Bahamusa Public Inquiry Report gave rise to recommendations that were then subsequently implemented. As at a matter of general ethos, then no. The causal chain is actually in the opposite direction. The MOD asserts that because they have improved the training, therefore there is no need for the investigations. Therefore there's no need for public inquiries to follow. The second question, is there any evidence that these improvements are motivated by an awareness that there are preventive obligations in IHL and in international human rights law? Truthfully, no. I think it's seen as a bureaucratic requirement that has had to be politically necessary. I do believe that the individuals designing the training have done so in good faith and very comprehensively, but that's not the same thing as understanding and engaging critically with the jurisprudence of the UCHR on prevention, which I can now only think of the McCann case in relation to Article 2. I think the Strasbourg jurisprudence on investigation is much stronger than on prevention in relation to Article 3. And yes, I think they need to focus very much more on prevention and on overarching command responsibilities to prevent violations.
Thank you. So, Thomas, your question about preliminary examinations at the ICC.
Yeah, thanks, Dow. I think your question probably hints at the fact that that these examinations are being conducted in not necessarily a very consistent way also, that you have certain, you have some examinations that have been going on for years and years, some even more than a decade, whereas others are, an investigation is requested perhaps only after months or even weeks of examination. It seems there's a lack of consistency in how the Office of the Prosecutor approaches these examinations. And will we see time limits? I think the OTP for sure would not be happy to see that being introduced. And the most obvious way, at least, of introducing it would probably be through, I mean, the OTP, an OTP policy paper, policy standard of some sort. So I think it's unlikely that it will happen. I think my personal view is that it would be good to have some kind of standards guiding how examinations are being conducted. We already have some in the policy paper, but to have more guidance also to ensure more consistency and perhaps part of the challenge in a sense goes to an understanding within the Office of the Prosecutor, within certain parts of the Office of the Prosecutor that I think came out quite clearly in a blog post by Emmerich Rodier on the blog that you are editing yourself, that was so ideal talk, where it seems to me at least that he's basically saying that yes, in a situation like Colombia, we do operate with, we do want positive complementarity to happen, and we think that has been achieved at least to some extent. It seems he's saying, whereas it would be a misunderstanding to think that that is what the office wants in a situation like UK-Iraq, and at the same time saying that whatever the office does is simply regulated by the statute, so there are no policy choices in a sense. Everything is determined and with reference to that legal statute. So to me, if that is what is being argued and that's how I understand that post, then to me that raises the obvious question, well, why shouldn't positive complementarity be pursued in the UK? What is it that makes the UK different in the sense that you do not wish to promote that genuine domestic proceedings take place? And of course there could be different answers to that. One is that one possible answer is that I suppose it would be quite politically sensitive for the ICC prosecutor to say that it wishes to influence how the UK is conducting these investigations, even if it seems from my research at least that is exactly what the office has tried through different forms of engagement with the UK government. So I'm not sure if that actually really gives an answer to it, but it points to certain challenges at least, sure. I think.
Melanie, just quickly, any legal issues on the horizon? Yeah, you can use that mic.
In our cases in the Iraqi civilian litigation, we still have some outstanding issues relating to cases in which the detainees were captured by the UK and then transferred to US forces or Iraqi forces. So some of these issues were dealt with as preliminary issues, joint liability and foreign act of state, but how these principles then are being applied to the facts, that's still left to be determined. Some of our pleaded cases deal with these issues and they're awaiting trial at the moment. So this is one of the outstanding questions, I think, that's still, you know, that what is the UK's liability for acts committed by forces of a different state in relation to Article 3. Tortures or mistreatment. That's an issue. Not in our litigation, but I think more generally, the drone cases are outstanding issues. But I think there's not much from what the Supreme Court seemed to have said in Belhaj and Rahmatullah. It would be really unlikely that they'd be barred by doctrine of crown actor state or foreign actor state, so they would be really difficult to bring in this country. And I think there's still the outstanding issue as well, just thinking of in Al Sadoun with the Court of Appeal, the issue of prior control over in the physical control and test, so prior control of an individual in relation to shooting cases. This is quite still an outstanding point as well, which still hasn't been really determined. So that's it.
Thank you. How do we do this? I've had a few ideas. I've had them before. First of all, derogation. So prior to commencement of hostilities, we derogate. That could be seen as a combat indicator. In other words, why are you derogating if you're not going to, if nothing's afoot? But it depends on the proximity you have to derogate vis-a-vis actually taking part in hostilities. So that's the first thing, to loosen up the regime to make it easier. Secondly, is a separate legal team for the prisoner of war facility. In other words, we did ask for this, actually, in January 2003. That was told we couldn't have it. But I would my estimate for that sort of volume of prisoners, 150 lawyers. No, it's bigger than the entire institution. So it would swamp us, completely swamp us, take everyone out. Every lawyer out of the British Army would simply surge into a prisoner of war camp if we'd had 15,000 prisoners. Third thing I'd do is I'd have a UK judge in charge of detention. In other words, the Army says, and again, we asked for this, but we were told we couldn't have it by the Ministry of Defence, we tried to bring a UK judge into theatre. In other words, we'd hand the whole responsibility for prisoners to a judge. And so you'd say in proceedings, oh, I just hand you Judge so-and-so. He was in charge of UK ops. The
Lord
reason
Justice
why that...
Leggett?
Sorry?
Lord Justice Leggett.
Fantastic. Actually, no. but there are plenty of judge advocates with military experience, for instance, who are used to living in the field, have a rank, and so on and so forth. So hand it all over to a UK judge, and therefore they can answer on behalf of the armed forces. Why was it stopped in 2003? Because we were probably rendering prisoners. In other words, they didn't want a UK judge poking around our detention facilities because the MOD were conducting this and they didn't want independent judicial oversight. The last thing I'd say is that one thing I've learned from all of this, and I was a small footnote, but having read Ian Cobain's book and seen the greater historical sweep of this, culturally people have a real antipathy to legally scrutinising their armed forces. And that's all the way through these campaigns. But what the British do is that they deny it, undermine the complainants, and now undermine the lawyers, and then in 40 years' time they admit it. So I will probably be dead or in a nursing home, at which case it'll all come to light. That's my prediction anyway, on that note.
Okay, well, thank you very much. First of all, to all of you who are here, we've gone beyond 3 o'clock, and I apologize for the fact that we've extended our discussions beyond 3 o'clock, but I hope you found it useful. So thank you to you for coming, and thank you very much to all of the panelists who are here from the morning and from the afternoon. Thank you to Leora as well for chairing. No thank you to Lawrence Hill Cawthorn for not turning up. The flu, I mean, what kind of excuse is that? But it's been a fascinating day. And I think really we've examined the whole sweep of issues that have to do with compliance with law and with international law in the context of armed conflict, human rights law, international humanitarian law, international criminal law, the interactions between these different branches of law, both at the substantive level and also to some extent at the procedural level in terms of training, investigations. So it's been a fascinating sweep, and also looking at the way in which these things operate in practice, both litigation practice at the coalface in terms of taking decisions operationally, practice in terms of pre-deployment training, practice in terms of prosecutions and investigations. So it's been fascinating. The last thing and the last word of thanks that I wanted to reiterate really is to Elizabeth, and she says also to Melanie, the two of you for actually having the vision to bring us all together to engage in this discussion, organizing it all, putting in all the hard work. So thank you very much to the two of you especially.